epistemology, how would we know? Moral psychology deals with questions like are moral, is the good necessarily motivating? So if you know what the right thing is that necessarily going to motivate you to do it? Or is it possible that people know the right thing to do and then don't do it anyway? Moral semantics is things like how we use moral language. What are we doing when we say something's right or wrong? Is that a statement, a fact that we're trying to make? Or is it kind of a performative utterance? We're just basically saying, I don't like it. So that's a very quick overview of the field. I'm going to focus on moral ontology. Now, this is a diagram. Don't worry about all the details. This is just a way into some of the different major meta-ethical theories. And this, believe it or not, doesn't even cover them all, but it gives you a sense of how it works. But the way into this is just to be looking at the questions, which then branch into yes or no answers, and which then different theories come under those different answers. So we're starting with the question, do moral judgments express beliefs? If you say yes, that's kind of cognitivism. If you say no, it's non-cognitivism. And under non-cognitivism, you get things like emotivism. And that's the view that when we say something's wrong, you're not saying any claim about the world. You're just saying boo, murder, boo for murder, I don't like it. and there's other kinds of expressivism. If you say yes, moral judgments do express beliefs, you end up with cognitivism. And then there's a question, well, are some of those true? And error theorists under non-factualism will say, okay, you're trying to make a claim, but you're systematically wrong about everything you say. So that's error theory. But if you say yes, some of those beliefs are true, then that's factualism. And so you get, then are those ethical facts metaphysically objective? And if you say no, then it's kind of moral non-realism. And that's things like constructivism, cultural relativism. And that's where we say, okay, there are moral truths, but they're entirely constructed by human societies and embedded in the laws. And so that's the only sense in which they are true, but nonetheless they are true, given that social situation. Moral realists say, no, there's more to it than that, and that there are actually metaphysically objective moral facts in the universe. And you might think, well, you'd have to have a god for that to be true. But in fact, you can have entirely natural moral realists as well. There's a whole bunch of them. I won't go into all the details. And then, of course, there's also non-naturalists, where you do have things like divine command theory, natural law, and a couple of others. So that's just a very, very quick overview of an entire course in meta-ethics. What's fascinating to me is that the different yogic traditions end up in different places in this diagram because they've got quite different metaphysics. So today we're just going to look at Patanjali. And Patanjali, there's a whole bunch of complexities. The Yoga Sutra is relatively short, like 195 sutras, but there are a lot of complexities. So things like the date and authorship of the Yoga Sutras, the relationship between the Yoga Sutras and its commentaries, the authenticity of a potentially important commentary, which I'll get to in the next slide, and the relationship between Patanjali's yoga and the different streams of Samkhya. Often it's just assumed that Samkhya does all the metaphysical heavy lifting and yoga is just a kind of an add-on to Samkhya. It adds in Ishvara, God, and otherwise there's no substantial difference, but I think that's a lot too simplistic and that influences the meta-ethics too. So the key text is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali and the commentaries, particularly that by Vyasa, inverted commas, which is very likely an auto-commentary. Philip Maas, who's done the only critical edition on the Yoga Sutra, as far as I know, and just the first chapter with the commentary, believes it's an auto-commentary and compiled from, drawing on some previous material, but compiled probably between 350 450 CE. But this makes a big difference. Like, if the commentary is an auto commentary, then that makes a big difference to what weight we give it in terms of interpretations. In terms of authorship, Larson had a view that it's possibly a Samkhyan by the name of Vindhyavasana, who had engaged in a very polemical debate with the Buddhist Vasubandhu's teacher. And so you can see traces of the influence of Buddhism in the Yoga Sutras as well. That seems as possible as any other proposed author, so that's possible. Together, the Yoga Sutra and the Vyasabhashya are often called the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, and often you'll hear it referred to by that name. I'm keeping them separate for the purpose of this analysis, especially because the commentary is too much to deal with as well. I mean, I draw on it a bit, but also because they're different literary genres as well. You've got sutra and you've got commentary, so I think it's useful to just keep them separate for the purpose of analysis rather than just mixing it up. And sometimes you'll read things where they refer to Patanjali Yoga Sastra 125 and quote a text and think, well, is that from the sutra bit or the commentary bit? And sometimes it's unclear. So I think it's just useful to keep them separate for the purpose of analysis. Got some other important commentaries. Vajrapasamistra's TV, I won't read it all out, is a very important one, a number of others, but one of the key ones which has generated a huge amount of controversy is the Vivarana on the last line, which is attributed to Shankara. There's just huge debate about that even now. One of the scholars, Rukmani, is very, very adamant that it's not Shankara and that it's a much later thing and therefore of less value. But others say, no, it's still a live option, that it's possibly attributed to Shankara. There was a hypothesis that Shankara wrote it earlier in his career before he converted to full-on Advaitin. We don't know. It's possible. Interested to hear Jim's perspective on that one as well. The relationship between Patanjali Yoga, Samkhya, and Buddhism is really important. So there's various early streams of Samkhya, not just one. One of the Chinese sources lists 18 different kinds of Samkhya. You know, whether these are fully developed schools or just individual teachers, you know, is impossible to know. But we know for sure that there was diversity of views in early Samkhya. And contrary to the later forms of Samkhya, in things like the Samkhya Sutra from around 1400 CE, most of the early forms of Samkhya were theistic. The difference is often whether or not they attribute the role of creator to Ishvara or not. So some of them, you know, many of them don't, some arguably do, but most were theistic. But most of the early Samkhya texts were lost as well, and so as a result, Ishvara Krishna's Samkhya Karika from around 354-50 CE came to be viewed as a root text for classical Samkhya, almost by default, because that's kind of the major text we have early on. And that doesn't mention Ishvara, so the impression emerged that authentic Samkhya as a whole was atheistic, and therefore the presence of Ishvara in the Yoga Sutra was kind of an incidental concession to an emergent theism, but not really integrated into Patanjali's overall perspective. It's a sort of an add-on extra. But I would submit that we can't simply read the Samkhya metaphysics of the Samkhya Karika, let alone the Samkhya Sutra, into the Yoga Sutras. It has to be allowed to speak for itself, recognizing the quite diverse milieu it emerged from, with this interaction between theistic Samkhya and early Buddhism as well. So, drilling down through those concentric circles, that initial diagram I showed you. So, Patanjali Yoga is a dualist philosophy with 25 tattvas, or levels of reality. You've got purushas, which are the individual consciousnesses, which are bound to prakriti. And prakriti is everything else, so mind, matter, energy, everything. And in some forms of Samkhya, the purusha is like pure content-less awareness, just consciousness, which sort of shines itself into prakriti, animating mind and so on. But everything other than purusha is prakriti, and that includes human mind as well. So it's a very particular understanding of consciousness in some of those forms of Samkhya. I will argue that Patanjali's, by the way he introduces Ishvara and the properties he ascribes to Ishvara, actually expands that notion of purusha a bit. So we'll get to that. But all of prakriti is constituted by the three primordial substances or gunas. So they are sattva, representing beingness, truth, goodness, purity, lightness, rajas, representing activity, motion, and energy, and tamas, representing heaviness, sloth, and darkness. So all of Prakriti is constituted by these gunas. And they're not, it's hard to find the right word for, I've got constituted in inverted commas, because it's not like a mereological arrangement, like things are part sattva, part rajas. You know, these sattva, rajas, and tamas are Prakriti. The human mind, it talks about in terms of three internal organs, the antahkarana. So you've got mahat, which Yoga Sutra calls the buddhi, and then asmita, the I maker or ego, also called amhankara in other parts of Samkhya, and then the manas as well. And then 16 to 25 are all the other aspects. A key point is that the closer an evolute is to the Prakritic matrix, so the higher up it is, the more sattvic it is. So sattva is, it's not only a kind of a quality of beingness, truth, goodness, and so on, it's like the highest quality. So when you get right down the bottom of the tattva, like earth and so on, that's like really heavily tamasic. And so you've got this sort of gradation of the gunic characteristics of the different tattvas as well. And that is important for the metaethics as we get to that. Sorry? 5 minutes. 5 minutes more. That is not possible. I will run through it quick. How am I doing? What time is it?
It's
okay, that's not possible. It'll be a bit more. But, yeah. So I'll run through the Ishvara part fairly quickly if I can. So Patanjali introduces Lord Ishvara, seemingly just another option in terms of devotion to Ishvara. But then he elaborates on it in the sutras, and I'll just highlight a few things. So in 124, he talks about Ishvara being a special Purusha. So he's not. So Ishvara, God, is not, is of the same kind of thing as the Purushas we all have in this, but he's special as well. So this, in Ishvara, the seed of omniscience is unsurpassed. And that is really interesting, because it suggests that it's not the pure contentless awareness that you get in other things, because it's got content, it's omniscient. This Purusha has omniscience. Ishvara was also the teacher, the guru of the previous yogis, and so that arguably suggests a degree of agency, and certainly the author of the Vasubhasya seems to hold that view. So when the commentary on 123 says, due to a particular kind of devotion, Ishvara is inclined to him, and by means of meditation he bestows favour. So there's this agentive language around Ishvara which you would not find in some of the other forms of Samkhya. And similarly, the author of the Vivarana, possibly Shankara, wrote that the Lord comes face to face with him and gives him his favour. And the perfection of samadhi comes through devotion to Ishvara. So there seems to be this agentive dimension to Ishvara, possibly. There seems to be a pretty strong realist philosophy coming through in Patanjali Yoga as well. In 4:14 to 16, he seems to be engaging with Yogacara idealism and rejecting that, particularly the last line, if an object is not dependent on a single mind, if it were perceived, then what would happen to it? So he's basically talking about the mind independence of objects. The human predicament, the world's characterized as one of suffering, similar to the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. The goal of practice is liberation, kaivalya, through meditation and ethical action, both of which make the mind more sattvic. If anyone wants these slides or want me to go back later on, that's fine. I know I'm whipping through them very quickly, but it's quite a lot of ground to cover before you can kind of get to how the metaethics works. So the human predicament, you've got three major challenges: vrittis, samskaras, and kleshas. So the vrittis are the fluctuations of the mind. So Sutra 1.2 introduces yoga, defining yoga as restrictions of the fluctuations of the mind. The vrittis, very importantly, can be afflicting or non-afflicting. So you can have non-afflicting vrittis as well. So part of the practice is cultivating these non-afflicting aklishta vrittis. Samskaras are subliminal impressions. They can also be of different kinds, either helping or hindering the goal of liberation. I won't go through all the detail. And then you also have kleshas as well. So he introduces Kriya Yoga, and he defines Kriya Yoga as austerity, self-study, and devotion to Ishvara again, and talks about the goal of Kriya Yoga being weakening these afflictions, these kleshas, and these are ignorance, ego, attachment, aversion, and clinging to life. And there are also, we're warned, these kleshas are the roots of our karmic deposits. So there's a direct relationship between these kleshas, the behaviors associated with those kleshas, and our karmic deposits. Then he introduces the eight limbs, which can be understood as an elaboration of the Kriya Yoga. So they include strong ethical dimensions. So you've got restraints and observances, the yamas and niyamas. I won't focus on the rest of the stuff, but because we're looking mostly at the ethics. The ethical restraints, the yamas and observances, are explicitly emphasized in Patanjali's scheme as the first and second of his eight limbs. So the restraints are things are non-harming, truthfulness, not stealing, celibacy, and greedlessness. And they, he describes them as the great vow, the Mahavrata, and irrespective of your birth station, your time, place, or circumstances, they apply universally. So there's no get-out clause for a yogi wanting to follow this path. They're described very strongly as the great vow. The observances, similarly, are purity, contentment, austerity, self-study, and devotion to Ishvara. Ishvara, again, coming up. And some of the commentators have said that those observances are also part of the great vow as well. The ethical action and liberation. So the four practices are enjoined to promote citta prasadanam, lucidity of the mind. And they include maitri, friendship, and you notice the Buddhist terminology, and karuna, compassion, as well as joy and equanimity. So the first two of those have pretty strong ethical dimensions as well. And so you can see there's again relationship between the refinement of the mind, making the mind more sattvic, and the ethical conduct. And he also advises intentionally counteracting harmful thoughts with helpful ones. Again, so this is part of the practice of cultivating positive thoughts to counteract harmful ones, functions as a way of purifying one's citta to make it more sattvic. When the intellect is wholly sattvic, liberation becomes possible, like the dissolution of the veil between the prakriti and the purusha. Can a Patanjali yogi become a Jivan Mukta, one liberated while alive? The Samkhya Karaka certainly speaks of that possibility, likening it to a potter's wheel that keeps spinning after the potter stops turning it just because of the momentum. I think it seems to be possible in the Yoga Sutra. It talks about the cloud of Dharma Samadhi, and from that coming the cessation of affliction and of karma. It's debatable. I think it's possible. The Vasubhasya says upon the cessation of afflicted actions, the enlightened person is liberated while alive. So certainly the author of the Vasubhasya was on board with the idea of the Jivan Mukti. So it does matter if the author of the sutras is the same person who wrote the Bhashya, in terms of the weight we give to that interpretation. Right, we've gone through a lot real quick. Where are we on this diagram? Do the moral judgments express beliefs? I'd say they do. It's cognitive because it is expressing beliefs about the nature of the way moral language functions and so on. I'd say it's also factualism because he's not going to say, this is cognitive, but then they're not actually true. He's not an error theorist, very clearly. I would say he's also a moral realist because he's talking about the way that the morality is closely linked into the very structure of the universe with the gunas, with the sattva. So you're trying to make the mind more sattva through your meditation and your ethical behavior, and that has real effects on the quality of your mind, like cleaning a dirty window. Are they entirely natural? Well, not really. So I'd say it's a form of non-naturalism, because we're talking about purushas and so on. You can make a case that it's a form of naturalism. We can argue that point, but I think it's arguably not. Where does it end up? I think it's closest to a form of natural law theory, but not like Aquinas or Thomas Hobbes and so on, because in this form of natural law, God, it's not coming from God. It's coming from the structure of the universe in terms of the gunas and sattva. So God is there, Ishvara is there. Ishvara may possibly be have agentive qualities, able to bestow grace, perhaps, but it's not driving. God is not driving this. It's the goodness. So conclusion, I'd say it's a cognitivist, factualist, moral realist, non-naturalism. So that's a mouthful. More specifically, a form of natural law theory, but quite different to the natural law and the Abrahamic traditions. God plays little role. I would say, the natural principle of sattva governs the metaethics, and unethical conduct is and remains an obstacle to samadhi. So I don't think there's anything in Patanjali that justifies the idea of, we get to this non-dual point where ethics doesn't matter, there's no real right or wrong anymore, and you kind of pass beyond that. For Patanjali, because of the structure of the gunas and so on, you start doing bad things, you end up enmeshed in rajas and tamas again, and so there's no point beyond morality, I don't think, for Patanjali. So in Patanjali system, the yoga, advanced yogi should also be a good person, I think. That's it.
Thanks, Brad.
It's a lot.
Yeah, and thanks for reading through the last bit. Yeah, it was great. It's nice to know that a yogi should be a good person. Yet.
Well, it's not clear in some of the other traditions, that's why it's so interesting.
Alex, if you want to go for it.
Just in terms of the question of what makes something a good action for Patanjali, would you say it's just a question of what conduces to liberation makes it good, or are there other considerations?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, he has been criticised as being, well, not criticised, but observed, this seems to be very much just an instrumentalist approach. You're good because that's, not because you're aiming for the good, because you love the good, and as in some other traditions, it's this is what you have to do to achieve liberation. This is the way the universe works. This is the deal. This is how the gunas work. You've got to kind of clean that window, so you dissolve that membrane between Purusha and Prakriti, and this is how it's done. And so it's instrumentalist, and I think that's arguably true in this system.
And when you talk about dissolving the membrane between Purusha and Prakriti, sometimes liberation in this system is expressed as realizing the total distinctness of Purusha and Prakriti.
Yes, when they, so there's a phenomenological language in terms of dissolving the membrane and achieving that liberation. I think they're always eternally distinct. In ontologically, I think, eternally coexistent, ontologically distinct. But I think my reading of what happens in liberation is the individual Purusha potentially is then freed from enmeshment in Prakriti, and so is not reborn or not. Yes, the language, it's hard to describe, I think, because it's not so much that the Purusha is reborn into Prakriti, and Purusha is always separate, but is somehow bound to particular Prakritic circumstances and life. And that's also, there's a moral interesting question in there as well about if the Purusha, because karma doesn't accrue to a Purusha, it accrues to the Prakriti. Well, everything karmic is Prakriti. So if the Purusha is, if the karma is not the Purusha's karma, what are the moral issues in a given Purusha being assigned a particular Prakriti circumstances for a lifetime and being bound to that and then bound to the next one and then bound to the next one? If the Purusha is just pure contentless awareness, as it is in some forms of Samkhya. So that suggests maybe that the Purusha has a role in an agentive role as well, like Ishvara does in prompting the desire for liberation, perhaps. Perhaps.
So if I could sort of follow up, I think you maybe answered this in some way, but is there like a explicit sense of what the experience of the Jivan Mukti, the Jivan Mukta is like? Like, is Prakriti still evolving and these tattvas still developing? And if so, that seems, because it seems like ahanta, ahankara is one of the tattvas in the system, the Sankhya system, out of which all of these other things develop, like the physical world. It's earlier on the pyramid, it's higher up on the pyramid than the physical world. But presumably you get rid of ahanta, ahankara in liberation. So do you have a sense of how that fits in?
I think, well, if you're still alive, you've still got the human mind. So you don't, until death, the Purusha is still bound to the Prakritic embodiment that it is tied to, I think, is one way of describing it.
And that would involve ahankara in some way.
Yeah, but I think, so part of the practice then is cultivating, the good samskaras or the aklishta, non-afflicting vrittis and so on like that. So I think it's influenced by other traditions. I mean, some of the early Jains, had the view that you can't do anything because anything you do is going to create karma. And so some of them at a certain stage renounced all activity, all everything until they just died. And I mean, Patanjali doesn't go down that route. There's not a lot in the commentaries, I don't think, about the Jivanmukta, but it seems possible, putting the pieces together, that it is possible to be liberated and remain alive. I mean, there's no suggestion in Patanjali or the commentaries that liberation only happens at death, or it must be immediately followed by death. So there must be a way of liberating, living as a liberated yogi. It is controversial, though. I'm not saying, and this is not a knockdown argument in terms of the possibility of Jivanmukta. I think, on balance, I think it's possible, but it's not certain. There's a modern ashram with a modern Samkhya Patanjali guru, and their practice has been renouncement and sort of being walled off in a cave for most of the year, but still not total inactivity. A guy wrote major commentary and interacts in one, and then the current one sees disciples 8 months of the year, kind of thing. So it's not total isolation and inactivity like some of the early Jainas. So I don't know if he claims to be enlightened either, so that's, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, that's helpful.
One thing that is quite striking when you presented these different authors is the interdisciplinary nature of those particular authors. So you have the Jnana Bhikshu, who's also a Vedantin, a Veda-Vedavadin. And if that other commentary is by Shankara, then you have Advaita, obviously. Bhoja is widely known for his work on Rasa Tattva, classical Indian aesthetics, based on Sankhya, but his own version of it. So I'm wondering, looking at this from the perspective of meta-ethics, I can't help but wonder whether, how that would work for individual authors, because the meta-ethics of Advaita would be fairly different to yoga, and I wonder if it colors their own, if one colors the other.
Yes, I don't think the Advaita dimension comes through really strongly in the commentary that's attributed to Shankara.
Might not be his, then, eh?
Or the argument was he converted later on, like it's an early work. Who knows?
Could I ask a question from outside about analytic philosophy?
Of course.
I was just a little bit... Can I just ask, so given the way you said what meta-ethics comprises, and you mentioned metaphysics and epistemology and moral psychology and semantics, where would you place this within that?
This one was focusing on moral ontology.
It was focusing on moral ontology.
Yeah.
Okay, so then the other question I just had was, you seemed to emphasize, I was sort of, because I'm really outside, I hope you don't mind
the
question. It's just that it sounded like there was so much emphasis on the individual and the practice, that it seemed a bit of a leap at the end when you talked about truth. And I wondered where it came in your talk, because you said he was a cognitivist, and a factivist, and you emphasized truth, and it was a moral realist.
Yeah.
So that's all to do with truth. And I'm just not sure where it came in what you said. I wonder if you could sort of go through the slides and just point out
at what point.
Because a lot of the emphasis seemed to be on the subject side and the development of the subject, or how one develops oneself. And I'm not sure how you got this out
of... The practice is certainly on the self and the cultivating a more sattvic mind and so on, but the overall metaphysical framework is saying the world, the universe is structured in a certain way. It's dualist, there's Purushas, you're in Prakriti, you're attached to a Purusha. The gunas govern the fluctuations of Prakriti.
So that's the bit I just didn't know about, and you were kind of taking,
So it's that kind of saying, this is how the world is, and it's not...
But what is it about the way you talked about the cultivation, one's own cultivation through the practice, that makes it not instrument, but not factual as opposed to non-factual? I mean, I I'm just not sure, you know, why couldn't it have been an error theory?
That's a good question. So you're saying, you know, if it's expressing beliefs about the way the world works and the, you know, are there moral facts and so on, you're saying, you know, are some of those beliefs true? Well, I think I would just argue that he, in the sutras and the commentary, making some very strong statements about the way karma works, the way the kleshas work, the way the vrittis work, and how they relate to the sattva and the gunas and so on. And so he's not going to set all that up and then say, oh, but that's all, none of it's true. Because error theorists, they agree that people are making factual claims about morality, that people are going around saying that murder is wrong as a factual claim. And they just say, well, they're just systematically wrong about that because there are no such things as moral facts. So that's what an error theorist would be. And I think saying, well, Patanjali is quite clearly not doing that.
Right.
He's making really strong claims about the enduring need for ethical conduct as a great vow. It's not something that you pass beyond at some point in your yogic journey. It's forever until you die. So.
Excuse me. I wonder if, in that context, you could throw light on a Upanishadic passage I've always wondered about. There's a part of the Kaushitaki Upanishad where it says, Indra says to whoever he's teaching, if you know me, you won't be harmed by the killing of a Brahmin, or even of your parents, or a fetus, as someone says. And it seems to express this sort of sense that if you have true yogic knowledge, you're beyond mere phenomenal details like right and wrong.
Yeah. Yes. There are certainly some of the yogic streams that do take that kind of route. Some of the non-dualist ones. Like, for example, I think my view is I think that non-dual Shaivism ends up at that very bottom line of hermeneutic fictionalism, which is basically saying moral judgments don't actually express beliefs about the way the world is. It's more a kind of a performative thing. So we might talk about things being right or wrong, but it's for the purposes of this play that we happen to be in now. But none of it's really real. None of it's ultimately real. It's just a play, and we are acting out roles. And for that purpose, we talk about right and wrong, but it's not ultimately real.
Do you think that some sutras of Patanjali could lend themselves to that interpretation? For example, the one... 4:30, tataha klesha karma nivrittihi. It sounds almost like sort of freedom from karma. And so if I get to that stage where I'm free from karma, can I?
No, because if you start doing bad things, you immediately are enmeshed again in tamas and rajas and so on, and you lose your purely sattvic mind.
So for Patanjali, would I be re-enmeshed because of the action? Or because of the mental state that precipitated the action?
I don't think he'd separate them.
Oh, really?
That's my guess. I mean, others may have a different view, but I think then they're so closely bound up, like the state of mind and the quality of the quality of actions and so on. I think Alex, you're frowning. Do you have a different view?
Potentially, I have no idea, but yeah, that distinction is very clearly made between Jainism and Mimamsa, where it's very clearly the physical action that causes the karma, and Buddhism, where it's not the physical action, it's the intention that causes the karma.
Yeah, I mean, Patanjali, I think, has both, because he's on about, you know, the vrittis and the fluctuations of the mind and the need to get that under control and the possibility of both helpful and unhelpful samskaras and the need to be not bound by the kleshas and so on as well.
So it's all prakritic.
Yeah, and not just prakritic, but tamasic and rajasic. Yeah. So you have to keep more and more refining, more and more sattvic, more and more sattvic, and that's both through meditative practice and through the quality of your actions, I think.
Thank you, Pat. I'm curious, we should probably ask about some relations to some of the interweavings with some of the Buddhist terminology and how far, as well, like some of the terms you're using in the presentation, like where they match up and where they don't match up. So, for example, like you talked about how the things can be conducive or not towards liberation. We use kind of like different words for that. And like in Buddhism, you can have wholesome or translation, right? Wholesome and unwholesome actions and also neutral actions. Mm-hmm. But I didn't hear any talk of like neutral actions in this. And apart from the fact that you could somehow be free of karma. And so I'm curious about that. And also just...
I didn't say that you could be free of karma.
Oh, sorry, that was a translation.
Right.
At the time of moksha, then you've got rid of karma.
Yes, okay, right.
So I'm wondering, you know, what action is at that point, or are you only doing good actions at that point? So there's only good and also if those are accurate, like, because there are Buddhist terms involved as well, you know, like, there's no morality or immorality in dependent origination, like that's also a construction, and I'm wondering if there are any more distinctions we want to make or that are helpful for people learning about the system you're explaining to
how
it all comes together.
There's a paper done in the 50s, I think, Valet de Poisson, who identified something like 50 different Buddhist terms that are used in the sutras. So there's a lot of engagement with Buddhist thought, but I think also a pretty firm rejection of things like I'd Buddhist idealism in there. In terms of liberation, I think I don't know what happens. I mean, it's possible, you know, if a yogi is liberated, then he no longer has any desire whatsoever to do anything wrong, and so therefore can't, and so therefore doesn't produce bad karma. That's possible. Is liberation, once achieved, a necessarily permanent state? I don't know. Can people backslide and become re-enmeshed in tamas and rajas by succumbing to temptation or allowing, you know, letting their guard down, allowing the vrittis to start fluctuating again and getting enmeshed in kleshas and so on. I don't know. I don't know if that even begins to address your question, but...
So it sounds like you would keep doing good actions once you're achieving
I don't think, yeah, well, I don't think, there's certainly, I mean, the Maharatta is really clear, like, this is a great vow, it applies under all circumstances. There's no hint that there's a sunset clause on it. It endures, and part of the reason it endures is because if your action is not sattvic, then you just get re-enmeshed in the other gunas and dragged down again, I think. The mind is no longer purely sattvic.
It's interesting. The text that I'm studying has its conception of jivan mukti seems to be a destruction of vasana, which is sort of similar in a sense to its...
The vasana is used as or twice.
But then it also seems to say that jivan mukti is about getting sattva vasana. So there's an ambiguity between the two, and it seems like maybe that there's an ambiguity here as well. Or would you say it's purely on the sattva side of that dichotomy?
What is?
So it's not about destroying the kleshas or your karma, it's about transforming them into sattvic forms of themselves.
Well, the samskaras can be, it talks about, uses the language of burnt, so they can be neutralized or burnt. They never completely go away, but you can neutralize them through the practice. And interestingly, in one of the commentaries, like Ishvara is described in terms of being pure sattva as well. So there's almost a sense in which, like, is sattva, this is another question I don't know the answer to, is sattva conceived entirely and solely in the prakritic realm? Or is what characterizes Ishvara? Ishvara is described as sattvic as well in one
that's
place. So that's interesting too.
Yeah.
And
if you get an answer to that, I would love to know.
So
it's directly relevant to a question.
Yeah.
But
same for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's the big question.
This is in the realms of the commentaries.
Okay.
Then when they talk about these different views. So.
I think we'll have one more question from Jacob.
So you said that the liberated being still needs to be a good person, because if they were to do something bad, they would get re-enmeshed in samsara. Which makes me wonder how, if someone can achieve liberation before dying, any action they do, whether it's good or bad, if there is karma involved with any action just in virtue of the physical action, then even good actions will create rebirth. And then it's not really liberation.
That's certainly the view, and that's like certainly the Jaina view. I think, I don't think it's so clear in Patanjali, because I think, because of the way he talks about different kinds of samskaras, different, you know, that it's possible to cultivate the good ones through your, like, if your actions are purely sattvic, it's possible to maintain that state. I don't think you get in Patanjali a necessary connection between any action whatsoever and karma, which is going to result in rebirth.
The idea of the potter's wheel is, at least in Vedanta, I'm wondering, it might be the same in Patanjali's system. The potter's wheel is spinning, and you let go of it because of the quality of one's mental state. So you're not generating any new karma, and you're simply experiencing what has been created already previously, but nothing new. There's no additional force. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, I think that's possible too. The other complicating factor, I think, is that the overwhelming preponderance of the emphasis of the sutra is on achieving liberation. There's very little on what happens after that. there's no suggestion that you can only be liberated when you die. There's no suggestion that liberation is going to kill you. So I suppose it's a bit more speculative what happens after liberation. But at least one of the commentators, Vasubhasya, who may have been the author of the sutras, talked about in terms of Jivamukta as well, liberated while alive. So, and it's just sort of drawing the implication would be that if you're going to be alive and you're liberated, then your actions must be sattvic, or else, if you're acting at all.
That's 6 o'clock. So I can cut it to a close, but if people want to stay around and chat a bit, you're welcome to. Thanks everyone for coming. I think, just to reiterate that if anybody wants to speak at one of these, a grad student, and has something related to Indian philosophy, feel free to contact Alice Hank or me or Jessica. And also just one final thing, that as payment for coming here, everybody has to take a leaflet for the upcoming Buddhist philosophy conference. Just to be aware of it, and there's some QR codes and links to follow if
so
people want to get tickets. But just a bit of an advertising plug. But other than that, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Alan. I'm not a Mac user. How do I disengage this?
No, Alice Hank did most of the organizing.
Thank you very much.
Switch that off.